headlines. The West Bank city of Nablus becomes a flashpoint of tensions, with Israeli military carrying out a deadly raid into a Palestinian neighborhood. Leader of Lebanon's Hezbollah resistance movement says that it will not allow Israel to even dream of plundering the nation's resources. Also in this newscast, Iranian satellite Khayam blasts off aboard a Russian Soyuz rocket out of the Baikonur Cosmodrome in Kazakhstan. Well, welcome to our studios here in the capital, Tehran. This is Muse. Thanks for joining us. The Israeli military storms a residential area in the West Bank city of Nablus, killing a Palestinian resistance fighter. Ibrahim al-Nablusi was killed after regime forces surrounded his home and hit it with a rocket. He was a commander of the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigades. The raid also triggered an exchange of fire between Israeli troopers and Palestinians. It left two Palestinians dead and scores of others, including a woman, injured. Meanwhile, Palestinian resistance movement Hamas says Palestinians are united in their fight against Israel until they bring an end to the occupation. The Israeli military has been conducting almost daily raids in the occupied West Bank over the past months. The raids frequently prove deadly to Palestinians who protest Israeli atrocities. The Secretary General of Lebanon's Hezbollah resistance movement says that it will not allow Israel to even dream of plundering the nation's resources. Said Hassan Nasrallah warned the regime against miscalculating Lebanon's resolve amid a maritime dispute over Israel's attempt to take control of Karish gas field in the Mediterranean. Nasrallah was addressing hundreds of mourners commemorating the Day of Ashura. The Hezbollah chief also said resistance is the only path to the liberation of the Israeli-occupied territories and reaffirmed support for the Palestinian cause. He then slammed as shameful the move by some Arab states to normalize ties with Israel. Nasrallah said Bahrain is a case in point for pressing its own Muslim population while welcoming Israeli officials. Millions of Muslims in several countries are marking Ashura, the martyrdom anniversary of Imam Hussein, the grandson of the Prophet Muhammad. Iraqis converged on Imam Hussein's shrine in the city of Karbala to show their grief and perform mourning rituals. People also gathered in mourning processions in the capital, Baghdad. Mourners also rallied in the Lebanese capital, Beirut, to commemorate the sacrifices of Imam Hussein and his companions on Ashura. The occasion has also been marked in different cities of Canada. The martyrdom anniversary of Imam Hussein was marked in Iran on Monday. Ashura is the 10th day of the Muslim calendar month of Muharram. It's the day when Imam Hussein and 72 of his companions were martyred in the plains of Karbala in modern-day Iraq. They were killed by forces of the tyrannical ruler of the time, Yazid, in 680 AD. Muslims in London have also commemorated the martyrdom anniversary of the third Shia Imam and his companions. Saeed Purisa has reported from the British capital on that.
Throngs of Londoners marching through the center of the British capital to commemorate Imam Hussein, the grandson of Prophet Muhammad, brutally murdered in the Battle of Karbala 1400 years ago. Similar processions in the rest of the UK and the world to mourn him and his 72 companions killed along with him, among them members of his family. Their crime, standing up to the tyrant of the time, the Caliph Yazid.
It was a tragic incident that happened many years ago, but the moral stand that Imam Hussein took has transcended time and space. Its reverberations felt through generations, and this is proof of it.
Many generations later, men, women, and children flagellate themselves to identify with the suffering of the Prophet's grandson, a man of morals who strived for social justice.
Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam represents all of the martyrs in all the world throughout human history and planetary geography.
For me, he represents justice, bravery, and sacrifice.
And it's not just the mourning that unites the people here. For them, the march is an annual chance to share the legacy of Imam Hussein beyond the borders of their countries of origin. Saeed Purza, London.
Let's go back to our story regarding what has occurred in Nablus. Monica Ndil is a correspondent joining us there, joining us from occupied Ramallah, that is, to give us the latest on what has occurred there. And Saeed Nimr is a professor of political science at Brzezet University, who also joins us from occupied Ramallah. Welcome to you both. Well, first to you, Mona Kandil. Tell us exactly who got assassinated, because maybe a bit of confusion as to who he is exactly. And also, what we're looking at in terms of the depth of this raid, if 70 people got injured or 69 people got injured, it was a pretty big raid then due to the number of people who got injured.
We have to mention first that the Israeli military continues to raid Palestinian areas, cities, refugee camps, and towns on a daily basis. And they continue to arrest people. They continue to kill Palestinians in cold blood. What happened this morning is that Israeli forces raided Nablus city and surrounded the house. It said it was owned by Ibrahim al-Nablusi. This Palestinian fighter, let's say, member of the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigades, and he was wanted for the Israeli military. The Israeli soldiers clashed with Palestinians who were inside the building. At the end of the day, the Israeli military revealed that the main aim of the operation was to kill Ibrahim al-Nablusi, who evaded numerous assassinations in the past, and a number of his friends were killed by the Israeli soldiers in Nablus. But this time, the Israeli forces unfortunately succeeded to kill this Palestinian fighter, who was seen by many Palestinians as a hero. His friend also, his friend was also killed during this operation, Islam Sbouh, 25 years old. And there is another Palestinian, a third Palestinian, actually, a teenager, 16-year-old, Hussein Jamal Taha, was shot dead during this operation. As you have mentioned, we are speaking also about over 40 Palestinians were wounded during this operation. The aim of the Israeli military was to kill Palestinian fighters. It was the same aim of the Israeli military operation in the Gaza Strip, to kill Palestinian leaders of the jihad movement. So it's clear today, according to experts and according to the Palestinian resistance groups, that Palestinians being engaged in the different forms of activities, different forms of a struggle against the Israeli troops and Israeli soldiers would be bordering the Israeli military and the Israeli regime, the Israeli cabinet as well. That's why they continue to raid the Palestinian areas and kill people in cold blood. And let me say it's an assassination, what happened in Nablus this morning.
Well, Saad Nimra, when you take a look at, first of all, let's mention what our correspondent said, and that is the fact that this is not something that's not new. Israel raids neighborhoods on an almost daily basis, if not on a daily basis. So that is something that needs to be mentioned. But at the same time, for the way that Israel carried out this targeted assassination, coming days after another couple of targeted assassinations that happened in the Gaza Strip, do you think that Israel is ramping up these types of assassinations?
Well, in reality, yes, the Israelis are targeting the Palestinian targets everywhere. But what is new? And we should focus on that Israeli, they noticed in the last few months that there was a growth of the Palestinian resistance in the cities, such as in Jenin and in Nablus, and maybe that will be copied also to other cities. And that was very much alarming for the Israelis. Part of the operation was in the war on Gaza against Islamic Jihad, because the focus on Jenin refugee camp usually and the arrest of Bassam al-Saadi because of the Islamic Jihad Brigade, which are in Jenin. Now, this is alarming for the Israelis, and they want to eliminate the Palestinian armed resistance that exists in Jenin and in Nablus, because they are afraid, really, that will be copied in all other cities. And in such case, the Israeli will have a problem in arresting and wandering around, and that will give a growth to the Palestinian armed resistance, which we started to witness in the last few months in more and more operations against the Israelis and resistance when they come to the refugee camp or to Nablus. Recently in Nablus, there was many clashes, armed clashes with the Israeli when they arrived at the city of Nablus in many occasions. So now it is about time from their point of view to eliminate the Palestinians. And we expect also that there will be maybe another attack in the coming maybe a month or so or less to against Jenin again, because they don't want any kind of armed resistance. Now, the other thing that we have to understand, which is usually the Palestinian leaders in general and analysts, they are always talking about the reason for these operations are the Israeli elections. Well, the Israeli elections is important, and any Israeli leader would like to enlarge his supporters by these kind of operations. But this is not the truth only. The truth that Israel is the nature of Israel as an apartheid state, a racist state, that based on colonialism, definitely that and if there is no elections, do you think that the Israeli will stop attacking the Palestinians? So it's not just the elections. It might be a minor reason, but mainly they wanted to end the Palestinian resistance, especially armed resistance, to end it, whether it's in Gaza or in the West Bank, the cities of Nablus or Jenin or other cities, which now started to grow as an armed resistance to the Israeli occupation.
Thank you very much for that. Let me thank our correspondent, Mona Kandil, who reported to us from occupied Ramallah. Thank you, Mona, for giving us the latest there. Sadnir, thank you, Professor of Political Science at Birzeit University, also from occupied Ramallah. Are we going to now have, from what I understand, an interview with Karim Sharara about Ashura? Karim Sharara, Islamic scholar, joins us now from Qom. We're going to talk about Ashura rituals with him. Karim Sharara, when you take a look at Ashura, it's a culmination here that we're speaking of. Prior to speaking to you just minutes ago, we saw what was happening in Karbala in Iraq, which is quite inspiring. Given the sense of how coming out of COVID, you could see how people are still steadfast, obviously, Muslims, to their belief and the mourning and the way that they have come out showing this belief. Again, just in the past hour, we also had Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah from Lebanon, who thanked Muslims for their steadfastness when it comes to, obviously, Tasua and Ashura, and how they have really showed and outpoured their grief in this particular case in point. And one of the things that I'd like to ask you about is what he said, the message that this sends out to the oppressed people of different countries, in which he mentioned Yemen, for example, or even in Nigeria. Tell us what your thoughts are about that and anything else that you deem important on this very special day.
I mean, it's no secret that the message of Imam Hussein, his uprising, his revolution, the main message behind, I mean, our main takeaway from Ashura is that by leaning on God, by leaving everything that we have within the hands of God, even in the most dire of circumstances, this oppression will soon be lifted. I mean, sure, if you want to talk like in extremely worldly calculations, if you want to pit the army of Imam Hussein and his 72 companions against the thousands that were against him, this was a losing battle. But if we study how the matter went on, I mean, the battle of Karbala basically ushered in the end of Yazid and all of his companions. The battle of Ashura basically lifted religion up from very dire straits again. So when you see the oppression that exists all around the world, our main takeaway from this, from everything that's happened over the past 1400 years, is that by reviving or by remembering what happened to Imam Hussein and his companions, and by consoling ourselves with the fact that even in the most dire of circumstances, he was able eventually to become victorious through the message that he wanted to spread, we find some sort of solace in our oppression. And in rising up against this oppression, against, I mean, when we rise up for justice, for social justice, when we're brought down, I mean, repeatedly, again and again. Look at the resistance in Lebanon, for example. The resistance in Lebanon back in 1982, there was no, I mean, there were pockets of resistance, of course, but there was no quote-unquote Islamic resistance. So when we look at how dire things were at the time, I mean, when the Israelis invaded Lebanon, we didn't have anything to fight with. We barely had some machine guns, perhaps some very light weaponry, but by which we could cause insecurity for the Israelis. However, despite the oppression, despite everything we were up against, we were able, through the grace of God, to lift this oppression up, and then we had the liberation of the year 2000. Again, 2000, 2006, 2011, 2012, 13, 14, 16, 18, and up till now, every year, every time we've been able to, we stood against oppression. We stood on the side of justice.
Okay, thank you very much for that. We appreciate it. Karim Sharara, Islamic scholar there, talking to us from Rome. Thank you for your insight. An Iranian satellite is launched into orbit by a Russian Soyuz rocket from the Baikonur space station in Kazakhstan. The satellite, dubbed Khayam, is a remote sensing apparatus that will take high-quality pictures for use in environmental and agricultural research and the monitoring of water resources. Iranian Minister of Communications and Information Technology, Issa Zarifpour, says that the launch is the beginning of a strategic cooperation between Tehran and Moscow in the field of space. Russia also put an Iranian satellite into space back in the year 2005. That does it for this additional World News. Bye-bye for now.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
Insight. Welcome to Insight. On this episode, we will be discussing the current crisis in the global economic and financial system with Russian economist Sergei Glazyev. But first, this brief analysis.
Even before the war in Ukraine and the severe Western sanctions imposed on Russia, the global economic and financial system was entering a period of transition. Changes in the relative economic power of nations, particularly those of rising powers in Asia, began to challenge America's global financial and economic hegemony. In the US itself, more than 20 years of permanent global war in the name of fighting terrorism has financially, politically, and morally corrupted America. The financialization of the US economy destroyed US production and has created one of the greatest wealth gaps in history, with tens of millions of Americans living in poverty and hunger, and a handful of oligarchs with unfathomable wealth wasting it on personal pet projects. More than ever before in recent history, the United States is weaponizing economic sanctions, the global banking system, and the US dollar itself to wage economic war against whatever country that is not complying with its orders. This in turn is destroying the credibility of the very global financial system that the United States imposed on the world following World War II. The severe sanctions imposed on Russia by the West have exacerbated this larger historic transition, because for the first time, the majority of non-Western nations did not comply with Western orders to sanction Russia. And Europe is also suddenly faced with a severe crisis because of its dependency on Russian energy and raw materials. For the first time, there are serious efforts to replace the US dollar as the international trade currency, as well as efforts to create new international financial systems independent of the West. New systems which cannot be abused and weaponized by the West to wage economic war on peoples around the world. It's not yet clear how these new global economic and financial systems will look like, but what is clear is that they will be centered in Asia and will be very different than what existed previously.
Dr. Glazev, thank you so much for joining us on Insight. Doctor, you know, it's interesting because you wrote, prior to the Ukraine conflict, you wrote in your books, in your articles, about particular trends that were already occurring in the global economic and financial situation of the world. Things like weaponization of the dollar, things like using and abusing the banking system, that is the Western banking system that is dominated by the West, for political ends, for punishing countries. A lot of these other issues, which are very many, which we can't all list now in our conversation. And you were at that time already predicting that the current financial system in the world, the current economic banking system in the world, is going to change, and that we're going to be going through a transition. And of course, all of this was accelerated by the Ukrainian conflict and the reaction that the West showed to Russia, the sanctioning, the basically stealing of Russian foreign reserves in foreign banks, something that, of course, we as Iranians are very used to. This is nothing new for us. And we welcome you to the club now. So if you could please explain for our audience in as much detail as possible, what is the current global financial situation dominated by the West that is now coming to an end? Some of the main features of it, some of those main issues as to this current situation, and how is it that we are now transitioning away from this current system and into a new system?
Well, thank you very much for this opportunity. I shall try to explain the current situation from the viewpoint of the theory of long-term economic development. I am an expert in this long-term cycles theory, and the present situation is a situation of transition. The world is changing dramatically. It changes both technologically and institutionally. This time, we are going through two transitions. The first transition is technological revolution, the transition to the new technological mode, which means that the economy is suffering from the drastic changes in the technological structure. Each technological structure is the basis for the so-called Kondratiev long wave.
Yes.
These cycles have 50 years length, and every 50 years we have approximately we have technological revolution. This period is a period of depression in the economy, because the companies, especially in the developed countries, are suffering from the excess of capital in the obsolete industries. Mm-hmm. And it takes time to transfer capital from the obsolete industries to the new one. This transition started about 15 years ago, And now it is coming to the end. The new technological mode, which is based on nanotechnologies, information technologies, digital technologies, biotechnologies, bioengineering technologies, and now is formed, and its expansion is going on the with the accelerated growth. The growth rate of this new technologies is about 35% per year. At the same time, we are going through the institutional change. These changes are taking place in with much more longer periods. The Italian scholar and banker Arrighi studied the so-called long-term cycles, or he called this century cycles, systemic cycles of capital accumulations. And each such cycle is based on the specific institutional structure. For instance, during the last two centuries, we have seen the changes from the colonial type of economy, which was based on the huge world powers in Europe, British Empire, colonial empire, French Empire, Russian Empire, and so forth. Those colonial period of capital accumulation is more or less good explanations given by Marx. Mm-hmm. He showed in his papers that the main feature of this kind of economic structure is antagonistic conflict between labor and capital. This colonial period was characterized by the slave trade, by the exploitation of all over the world by the European empires, and there were no any social rights, no trade unions, nothing which could protect workers from the exploitations from the capitalists. This colonial type structure collapsed in the beginning of the 20th century. The First World War and the Second World War were provoked by the British in order to maintain the British Empire as a leader of the world. The point is that this transition period from one cycle to the another cycle usually is going on through the world wars, because the ruling elite of the leading countries do not want any changes. And at that time, 100 years ago, we have seen two world wars. Both were provoked and organized by British, and the Second World War also by the Americans, who made a huge investments in militarization on German Empire. And the idea of these two wars designed by the British was to have a conflict between Russia and Germany in order to prevent their development. At the beginning of the 20th century, Germany and Russian Empire together were in very close relations. And they produced more goods and they were more advanced. They had faster growth rates than British Empire. And it was quite clear that Russian and German Empire, together with Austrian Empire and Ottoman Empire, becomes a new center of the world. In order to prevent this formation of the new center of the world, British provoked the First World War, which destroyed all those empires, and Europe was also destroyed, and British maintained their world leadership till the Second World War. But at the same time, we have seen the Russian Socialist Revolution and the emergency of the principally new institutional structure. It was a structure based on the central planning economy, which was very new, and which demonstrated a huge growth rate. The industrialization and growth rates of not only of industrial production, but of the whole economy in the Soviet Russia was the highest in the world at that time. At the same time, In the United States, another type of this new institutional structure also emerged based on the transnational corporations. From the organizational point of view, the Soviet system and the American system were rather similar. The basic unit in organizational structure was large corporation. In the Soviet Union, it was called ministries, which organized production in this or that industries. In the Western world, they were transnational corporations. For the first time in the history, the governments invented the fiat money, which they used in endless scale. Mm-hmm. The government, the central banks, government central banks, started to print money in those quantities which were necessary to finance investments for economic development. For the first time, we have seen that the monetary limits were overcome. There are no any problems for the finance industrialization in the Soviet Union because the state bank printed as much money as were necessary to finance the growth of productions and investments. The only limits were physical resources. At the same time, in the United States, the Federal Reserve emerged, and Federal Reserves also started to print money in those quantities which were necessary for the American government to finance its budget and to stimulate economic growth. These two principally new, but politically opposite systems, they were common in the way of organization of production, but they were opposite in the political sense. In America, we have seen democracy. In Russia, communist totalitarian state. In spite of the political antagonism, those two systems demonstrated very fast growth, especially the Soviet systems, which didn't suffer from the Great Depression. The Great Britain started to lose its hegemony again. And again, they started to provoke the New World War, again, between Russia, between Soviet Union and Germany. Finally, the war finished with the political results, which was very astonishing for the British, because the British lost the empire, in spite of the fact that they were among the winners. They lost empire because the two superpowers emerged, the Soviet Union and United States, which were much more efficient than the British colonial type state.
That's right.
These large scale corporations and ministries organized production, mass production, in much more efficient way than have been done by the private companies in the British Empire. So British Empire collapsed the so-called imperial, as we define it, imperial world order began, dominated by the two superpowers. Now this cycle comes to the end. Mm-hmm. First, we have seen the collapse of the Soviet Union about 30 years ago.
Yes.
Now we are looking for the collapse of the United States. The Soviet Union collapsed because the central planning economy was very rigid, and it didn't satisfy for the needs of the science and technological progress. This was very a bureaucratic system which reject innovations. And finally, the Soviet Union began to go down in technological competition. And after the collapse of the Soviet Union, the United States becomes the only one leader. But this leadership was not forever, because the American system today is based on the creation of the fiat capital, which has no limits. You see, according to the Arrighi studies, each one-century cycle of the accumulation of capital has two phases. The first phase is material expansion. The new system of management, the new, more efficient institutions give opportunity for those countries which use these institutions to become the leaders in the industrial production, in the rail sector. But after two generations, the leadership in industrial sector transfers to the leadership in the financial sector. Mm-hmm. And the second half of this century is the financial expansions. Financial expansion of American capital now have such a scale that the efficiency in the rail sector simply doesn't matter. During the last 10 years, maybe 12 years, the amount of dollars in the world economy increased about four times. At the same time, we see that in China and in India emerge the new technology, a new economic system, which have much more complicated structure, which combine the central strategic planning with the market competition mechanism. The government control the money circulation through the government, through the state banking system. And at the same time, the private entrepreneurs, the private companies has access to the endless credit facilities, but they get this access only in those spheres which increase the production of the goods which have consumer demand. So this combination of central strategic planning and private markets and companies' competition gives new opportunities for the economic growth. The government creates, the central bank, government central bank creates money. The government controls the circulation of this money. It's due in such a way to avoid the speculations. They give opportunity to the private companies have a long-term credits, maybe half, 0.5 interest rate, even 0.2 interest rates, which are provided by the government banks for those companies which are able to produce more goods and give more opportunities for economic growth. And the government at the same time block the speculations which undermine the economic stability. For this reason, almost all money which are created by the state are going to the rail sector. Mm-hmm. And today we see that monetization of the Chinese economy about two times higher than American economies. Almost the amount of money which were created by the Chinese state bank during the last 12 years increased about three times. But this money was not going to the financial speculations, as in the United States. It was going to the production sector. And we see that Chinese corporations like Huawei, let's say, or Xiaomi, or China Construction, or Power Engineering Company, becomes the huge old corporations. They were created, especially in private sector, like Huawei, or Xiaomi, they were created just from nothing, from private cooperatives, which are growing up very fast because the government support these companies with the cheap credits. But at the same time, the government control with the use of the money. It's avoid the capital flight. The currency control is very strong. The yuan, RMB, is convertible only for current transactions for trade, but it's not convertible for the capital transactions. The capital flows are controlled by the government, and all this monetary mechanism is designed in such a way to promote investments. You see, the Chinese, as well as Indian and maybe Iranian mm-hmm. financial system, has a clear goal. To finance, first of all, new investments, to finance the growth of production, which is quite different from the American and Western system. where the money are created for the needs of the financial oligarchs. They print money in huge quantities without taking care where this money are going. The main idea to get super profits. For this reason, they create various derivatives, which in fact are pure speculative instruments. And these financial bubbles concentrate about 80% of the whole money created by the Federal Reserves. And the mechanism which we see at the moment in the West, financial mechanism, is going through the turbulence. It becomes very turbulent. Every 10 years, we have the financial crisis. And there is completely, almost no economic growth. There is no growth of the real income of the population. So American and European economy is in stagnation. At the same time, the Chinese and Indian economies are growing up very fast. So the world economy is switched to the new center in the South East Asia. We see the new world economic center, which dominates now in the world economy by the growth rates. More than 50% of the growth of the world economy is the growth in those Asian countries. This center is much more efficient. It wins economic competition. And the Pax Americana is going to the end, not because Chinese and Indian economies are growing up so fast, not because they were in miserable situation before. They're growing up very fast because they have much more efficient system of management, much more efficient institutional system. So this new type of economic organization combines the central planning for central strategic planning and private entrepreneurs. We call this type of state as integrated, integrative state, or integrated world economic mode. Because the main function of the state is the combination of the interests, the harmonization of the interests of various social groups. The American-style system is designed for the needs of the financial oligarchy. Exactly. The American system protects property rights for the large capital, and they don't care about the workers, about the population as a whole. And for this reason, we see the huge social differentiation, which finally go into the political destabilization, which we have seen during the last presidential elections in the United States.
Exactly.
As for the new type of the state in Asia, we see the socialist ideology. We see the huge role of the moral standards. The state is responsible before the people. The main idea of the economic policy is the growth of the incomes and living standards of the population. So this combination of the socialist ideology, of the traditional values, of market mechanism and central strategic planning, government control over the money creation, shows the huge efficiency. And it is no doubt that the last part of the present century will be dominated by the competition between China and India. Unfortunately, cost about 100 million people killed in the two world wars organized by the British Empire. And now the American financial and ruling elite is trying to maintain its leadership, starting the new world war. We call this war hybrid war, because the main front lines in this war are going in the financial sector, in the economic and trade sector, in information technologies, and only the final stage, they use the military power in order to press opposition and in order to finalize the expansion in the financial and economic and information sectors. But this is the real world war, because the idea of this world war, hybrid world war, is from the American side, is to maintain its world hegemony. And they don't care about other countries. Those countries which are not controlled by the United States are going through the culture, through the color revolutions. Exactly. The Americans are trying to undermine political stability. In those countries which they do not have control, they introduce various methods for chaotization of those countries. They provoke wars between countries. The main idea of them was to provoke the war between Russia and China. Fortunately, it didn't happen. Now the Russia and China have strategic partnership. And because the China is too large now, and American lose the economic competition with China, they're trying now to press Russia, to undermine Russia, to destroy Russia, in order to improve its position in the world by means of controlling the Russia natural resources and to prevent the growth of China. So American plan today has three stages. The first one, to destroy Russia, because, you know, the Russophobia is one of the long-term, have deep roots in Anglo-Saxon geopolitics.
Exactly.
The whole geopolitics theory of the 19th century, designed by the English and Germans, was the some quasi-science how to destroy the Russian Empire. It was the main headache of the Western geopoliticians to find methods how to destroy the Russian Empire. And the Ukrainian crisis, the war today in Ukraine, happened according to the recommendations of their geopolitical theory, starting from Bismarck and then following with Brzezinski. They stressed a lot of times that in order to destroy Russia, first of all, you have to get away Ukraine from Russia, because the formula of Brzezinski was that Russia without Ukraine couldn't be the superpower. And all this Russophobia, which was have deep roots in the Anglo-Saxon geopolitics, now played a key role. Why the United States use Russia as the main goal, to maintain the world hegemony. And Ukrainian provocation was prepared on the systemic basis during the 20 years, especially the last 8 years. They trying to control Ukraine. As you know, they organized the coup d'etat in Ukraine. The Ukraine during the last 8 years do not have independent government. This territory is totally controlled by the CIA and other American and British organizations. And the first stage for them is of this hybrid war. In fact, hybrid war began with the sanctions against Russia in 2014. And then the second stage was the economic war with China, where the American used the same methods as the British Empire used in the 30s, when British Empire prevented the access of American goods to their empire in order to get more compatible position in comparison with the United States. Now the United States did the same. They launched the trade war with China in order to maintain their markets and in order to limit the growth of China, but they failed in this war. Nowadays, they used sanctions against Russia. They intervened, in fact, in Russia military and cultural space. They are trying to destroy Russia with various information technologies and trying to use to provoke the war in Ukraine in order to undermine the Russian government. They want to chaotize Russia. And second, they want to destroy Iran. They do this, they're trying to do this permanently during the last 20 years. And their final goal is China. Taking control over Russia and Iran, American ruling elite thinks that they can deal with China on the...
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Welcome to another episode of the program Ulama's Speech. We express our condolences on the arrival of the month of Muharram and the martyrdom anniversary of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short speech by Ayatollah Javedan. Stay tuned. Our deeds become more important during the month of Muharram. For instance, if we take care of our eyes by not committing sins, we may shed more tears in this month. Or we have to be more careful about the food that we eat. We are not allowed to eat anything anyway. The effects of our good deeds are shown in our broken hearts and sad souls for Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam in the month of Muharram. Karbala,
as I step onto your sand, you capture my eyes. Karbala, I see heaven has been placed here beneath.
Our deeds have effects on our spiritual life. One good result of our good deeds, especially in the month of Muharram, is improvement of our spiritual understanding. One might ask, why my heart is not broken upon hearing the afflictions of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam? The answer is that our good deeds did not make a lightening understanding about Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam in our souls. If we find such a light within ourselves, then Allah will help us reach salvation through Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam.
Karbala, why do you hold such memories? Ashura,
thank you very much, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio Call of Islam page, for listening to this episode of the program Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short speech by Ayatollah Javedan. To find out more about this program, log on to our website, parstoday.com/en Call of Islam page. We leave you in Allah's care and goodbye.
New year starts with morning. Muharram is a beginning. The season's tears are flowing. Our Imam, we are condoling. Our new year starts with morning. Muharram is a beginning. The season's tears are flowing. Our Imam, we are condoling. Karbala, wow. God's precious blood was spilled there, Ashura. Al-Hussein was murdered here, Ashura. Al-Hussein was murdered here.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.